You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, July 1st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today to celebrate, what is it? Is it Canada Day? Something like that. It's Canada Day?
It's Canada Day. It's true.
To celebrate Canada Day, the great Cliff Schechter will be with us. Also on the program today, Michael will be interviewing Steve Cook from the Council of Foreign Relations. Maybe you saw him on Charlie Rose the other night. Well, Michael spoke to him just moments before that on what happened in Istanbul this week. This is a special type of Canada Day show, ladies and gentlemen. In honor of Canada Day, we have pre-taped this program, and we're not going to be we're breaking format just a little bit. Just a reminder, I want you folks to have a great 4th of July. On Monday, we will have no show. Then we'll be back Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday with some new long-form interviews, and members will get special Matt archives. And then that following Friday, a week from today, I'm not sure what's going to happen. Who knows? But ladies and gentlemen, before we get to any of that other house keeping or cleaning of houses or whatever it is, that's exactly probably what I'm doing right now, is cleaning that house. Just want to take this opportunity. Thank you, folks. You members make it possible for this program to exist. We couldn't do it without you. So I just wanted to thank you. And before I say anything else, before I talk to our first guest, I need to play this off of my board.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.com.
Yes, Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. How are you, Cliff?
I'm doing well, Samuel. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm technically on vacation. You, of course, were on vacation last week, and always a pleasure to catch up with you.
It is. Vacation's enjoyable, but you know, I miss my Majority Report fix, so I have to come back always.
So now here we are, Cliff. It is 2016. It is July 1st, and it's amazing when you contemplate that Mitt Romney thought Benghazi was going to win the election for him in 2012. And here we are, is the sixth, the seventh report has dropped on Benghazi, 800 pages. And it is, I mean, all of this is indicative. I mean, I know I said this on yesterday's program in the members part, but What is stunning to me is just like the Republican Party seems to be sort of like drilling to the center of the earth right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what I mean? They don't produce anything anymore or do anything. I mean, I guess they pass some votes here and there that where they still do standard things that that both political parties have always done in Washington. You know, they still name some post offices, I think. And yeah, they still pass some bills that have budgets in them here and there and do things, but do they come up with any new ideas anymore? Do they do anything that's not for political purposes anymore? I mean, it's been a good 10, 20 years that slowly this party has been collapsing on itself, sort of like a black hole has hit it, and it seems, you know, like it's become more and more of just a sort of authoritarian cult.
But it's not just that they're not doing policy, right? It's and you know, there's gridlock, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not just that they're not proposing policy. It's that even their politics just seems to be, they are completely constrained now from offering even empty rhetoric that is supposed to, that even starts with the premise like we're going to try to appeal to a broader spectrum of the American population than those people who voted in the primary, in the Republican primary.
And he voted for either like Cruz or Trump for the most part. Yeah, I mean, but that's kind of, the two are the outgrowths of each other, right? I mean, because they failed in terms of policy, sure, they block some things that the Democrats, plenty of things, obviously. But because Obamacare, which is nothing so much as their own health care alternative to Hillary care, as we know, and it's the same thing as Romney care, I mean, go on and on, and we've had these conversations before. But so they failed with that, and they've said again and again how they were going to get rid of it and they were going to stop it, and none of that ended up being true. So it's almost like they've got this starving beast they've got in a cage somewhere, and so they have to feed it. They got to give it something, and they haven't done any of the things they say they're going to do because they make ridiculous promises and don't base anything they promise upon evidence that actually exists, and don't much care for the Constitution, even though every once in a while, or quite often, I guess you'd say, they wrap themselves in it. So when they say, you know, they're going to get rid of abortion, and then the Supreme Court comes out and says, no, you're not, and in a pretty significant decision,
right,
says that things going on here in Ohio and many other states are unconstitutional, then they haven't delivered on what they've been saying they're going to do for 20 or 30 years, and not even close to it. So that, what do you need to do? You make up a scandal and you appeal to the conspiracy theories of these very same people that, you know, Hillary Clinton threw our guys to the wolves or didn't pay attention or whatever, and Barack Obama and whoever else they want to. I mean, they've made it more about Hillary Clinton more recently for obvious reasons, but it was about Obama, as you
right.
said, in 12. And so that's the result of their lack of any coherent policy agenda and sort of constant lying to their base that the people can have it all and are going to get it all. You know, they have to end up doing this. And I mean, $7 million is what they spent on this ridiculous waste of time. 800 pages, as you pointed out. For comparison's sake, the 9/11 committee, that report was 600 pages. And so,
and they only came out, as far as I remember, it was just basically the 9/11 report, and there was one congressional committee, and they weren't even close to still examining the 9/11 4 years later. Now, I would argue that they should have, frankly,
they should have in a nonpartisan way, as they should have investigated Benghazi, and there was an independent committee looking into it. Because the truth is, we should learn something from even if mistakes are not always made. Sometimes bad things just happen. I know everybody wants a reason for it, but sometimes
right.
when you've got an ambassador and you've got people in a war zone that's 5,200 miles away, that is on a completely different time, and it's, you know, and things are happening in real time, to coordinate all that and protect people is very, very difficult, and some people volunteer to go into these kinds of circumstances, and they're heroes, and you have to say they've got courage, but you can't be shocked when something like this happens. It's terrible. It's tragic, and yet it does happen. But would we want to look into it and see if things could have been done better, if security was lax, if there was a problem with how we were? Of course you do. You know, but to make this big a deal over this, with this guy's sister, the former ambassador's sister, saying, you know, stop politicizing this and whatever, dragging this guy's family through the mud, Ambassador Stevens, former Ambassador Stevens, I guess I should say, and you know, to doing all of this so that now the NRA is running commercials in a military graveyard on behalf of Trump, to do all of this stuff, but then to try to stonewall in the manner they did the 9/11 commission, something that, I mean, you know, Jesus Christ. I mean, we had an attack on our shores with airplanes flying into buildings in downtowns and hitting the Pentagon. You know, that might have been something that you would have put politics aside to look into and see who ignored all those warnings and who hadn't prepared for them. We had people like Richard Clark telling us who had, you know, but I mean, they did everything they could. So, I mean, they, you know, it's just that, again, they don't want to protect. They're all happy to protect it when it's their with a Republican administration and it's 3,000 Americans on, you know, in our cities. But when it's 4 Americans in the middle of a war zone half a world away, you know, that must be somebody's fault. And so when you compare those two things, it's so utterly ridiculous. And the truth is that all of us who believe in good government want them to do
right.
independent looks into both of those things and let the chips fall where they may. But that was never going to happen with Trey Gowdy and this group of goofballs. It just never was because we always knew what it was about because it's always about that for them now. And that's the problem, is that it's not just the partisanship, it's that those of us who actually, beyond our partisan affiliation, believe in good government, we've lost that too.
It's just, but it's, I all of that I think is true. And I think it's indisputable. I mean, I think, you know, you had their whip even say at one point, like, hey, we're doing this to score some political points. And, you know, the entire email controversy grew out of this. I mean, this was right. I mean, this was the catalyst and the bait, and this is the way that, you know, it led in the same way that all the Whitewater stuff did back in the 90s, ultimately led to Monica Lewinsky. But what is stunning to me is their inability to see that this is not resonating. Now, I guess to a certain extent, you know, the emails things have been successful in that sense. You know, we still have this question as to whether or not she will be indicted. I don't think she will, but, and I'm not sure that there's even a there in any meaningful way. But it's just stunning to me because we see this across the board. You know, I keep harping on them trotting out Scott Brown to use the Pocahontas stuff on Elizabeth Warren. Like, what kind of shape is your national campaign in when
right.
you are trotting out losers to go after surrogates by using a meme that is completely, that is, if it was comprehensible to the vast majority of Americans, would be probably seen as offensive. But nobody even understands what you're talking about. They're talking in code. You know, this is all sort of like drag the body to the park type of stuff. And
right.
and nobody knows what that means unless you're listening to you're still like a regular Dana Loesch listener or something. Or
they don't
you know,
exist.
Yeah.
You know, here's the thing too, which is on top of it, is that the only thing you might actually get out of this is something negative. So you know what you end up doing with this Scott Brown stuff you're talking about and everything is you end up with some idiot talk show host who's used to talking to the mirror, you know, with loons just like himself, who gets up and you know does the sort of I don't even know what you call it, right?
Yeah, the Indian
sort of chant,
Native American yes.
chant or whatever, which is clearly racist and obnoxious. Which and so now, you know, you've actually found a way to add another group to the list of groups that your candidate has offended. Also, by the way, a group that happens to have some actual voting power in a state like, oh, I don't know, Arizona, that's become a swing state,
right.
And where the Democratic nominee there for Senate, Kirkpatrick, is part Native American and is on the cusp of maybe beating John McCain. I mean, you're handing ammunition to your enemies. You're handing stuff over it's just such unforced errors. And they do it constantly, because you're right, because they're so used to talking to this sort of miniature world of theirs that supplies all the money and everything they need, you know, when they're just trying to load money in their pockets and their TV shows on Fox and all that stuff. But when you have to actually get outside of the Republican primary, you know, the like-minded people, and appeal to people that aren't, in fact, crazy and part of your little cult, you know, then everybody else doesn't, as you said, either doesn't get it or they do get it. They see some guy doing doing that chant and they're offended by it.
Right.
So it's just a net loss in every way. And the Benghazi thing, you know, it just nothing reminds me so much of this as, again, it's sort of like you brought up the late 90s and impeachment. Because every poll told the Republicans that people stood with Bill Clinton and thought that whether this was right or wrong, it had nothing to do with governing. But they made it a midterm issue, and they found a way to be one of the only parties to lose seats that's not that non-presidential parties in the second midterm in 98 because they wouldn't shut up about it.
Right.
And polls, you know, it's like we almost have opposite problems here. As we've often discussed on this show, sometimes we can have 90% of the population with us, and we can't seem to defend to convince Democrats to defend whatever it is or get behind it until it's like 112%. Whereas Republicans, when they've only got like 2% or 10% or 25% in favor of whatever it is, they can't seem to realize that, and they keep pushing it.
Well,
it's
do you
amazing.
Think it's, you mean, do you think it's a question of some type of a combination between stupidity, but also just sort of like to the extent that they're conscious of what they're doing, they're in they're between a rock and a hard place. I mean, I imagine like I just try and figure like how did it work out? I mean, because you know you've got a problem where you know Paul Ryan has to come out and say, well, I think that's the textbook definition of racism, but I'm not going to disavow him. Or you've got we played a clip of Mike Lee yesterday saying like I'm not going to support Donald Trump because his state Utah is you know the last Democrat they voted for was LBJ. Utah is polling against Trump, and on top of which. As Mike Lee said, like he said that my best friend's dad was responsible for killing JFK.
And even after that,
he has to tiptoe around the whole thing. It's like they realize like they're walking on some type of razor's edge here.
But it's kind of awesome, right? You hear him
say
awesome.
That. It's awesome. It's so awesome. And
you hear Paul Singer, you know, the huge hedge fund guy, right? Who is very, very economically right wing, is socially liberal, and still is a Republican and gives money all the time to Republicans, but won't support Trump. Say that Trump is going to cause a depression with his policies. So you've got him saying that. You got Mike Lee, and this is just the newest two I can think of. And Mike Lee, as you point out, saying he accused my best friend's dad of killing JFK.
but Mike Lee, the people in my state
aren't so fond of wanting to exterminate religions, and yet then you say to both of them, "Well, you vote for Hillary Clinton?" Oh well, no, I'm not saying that.
Right. They're so boxed in.
If you vote for Donald Trump, a giant meteor will come and hit the Earth. If you vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, it likely won't happen. Well, who are you going to vote for? Well, I don't know that I can vote for Hillary Clinton, even though Trump's terrible. I mean, you start wondering at what level of damage Trump would have to do, and they'd have to be sure that he would do, for them to say, I'm not going to only not support Trump. I might actually vote for the alternative.
Well, they can't. I mean, that's the point, is that they can't possibly say that because they'll be so punished. Like even their
Singer could say it because you've got Mark Salter, the right. McCain guy. I mean, you've got plenty of people outside or retiring or whatever. But you're right, Lee in Utah can't say that.
He can't say that, and he can't even go full hog on his criticism of Trump. He still is like, I still am keeping an open mind, though. I mean,
right? And he says, and I love that too because it's like he better start saying the right things as if that erases having said the wrong things. Oh,
right.
Well, he's saying nice things now. So I guess all the stuff he said about Native Americans, women, African Americans, Hispanics, you know,
your best friend's dad,
all that just magically disappears. He doesn't really think that anymore.
No,
it's ridiculous. And if you see, but what you see also, you know, you may have seen like Stan Greenberg. They just put out one of their battleground polls that showed. I don't think the results were uniform. In some of the states, it was closer than I thought. Some of the ones, it was further away. So I don't know. The end result is that quite clearly, if you look at the preponderance of polls out, you know, what you'd expect is going on, which is in some states with more heavily minority populations, Florida, for example, even that are swing states, Trump's in serious trouble. But then you start seeing he's losing white college-educated voters that Romney won, all right, that are often swing voters. And in places like Ohio that has a lot of universities, that's going to hurt him. And so he's down places like this. So his whole theory of things and the whole theory that Republicans have – it's killing them, and this is, you know, and this is where what we're talking about is because these guys will not disavow them in these states because they've got that 20% base they have to appeal to,
right?
But then they're standing with him, and they're standing with statements he's made, and even statements other crazy people in their party have made. Because this polling particularly looked at, like, would you want to stop terrorists from getting guns? Well, most people would like to do that. Would you want to – do you think abortion should be banned in cases of rape and incest? Well, most people don't think that. And thankfully, a majority, you know, now – and this is, do you think people – you know, that gays and lesbians should be able to get married? Yes. And so there's solid majorities. I mean, these aren't things that even poll, you know, 60-40. They're things that poll 80. 80-20. But they can't. They have to be on the wrong side of all of them to keep their base happy. So in the end, they're all. I mean, and this is in the supposed strong areas where you know this is in places like Ohio and Michigan where he was going to have this whole Rust Belt strategy. And it's like, guess what? You know, the Rust Belt may be a little more conservative than some other places, but it's still, you know, in the past I would have said it's still not Utah, but apparently Utah's not working for them
right,
either.
Right.
It's still not what? I don't know.
Utah's not Utah anymore.
It's still not Alabama? I don't know. Come up with something. You know, and so the point is that you're still on the wrong side of most voters on social issues here. You know, I mean, that's where you are at this point. So it's, you know, it's... I don't know.
It's just
what a mess. You know, what a mess. I know you're not going to Cleveland.
No, I mean, I'm starting to regret that now that I understand the neo-Nazis are going to show up. I mean, I hope that they. I'm just referencing the story that's out there now that those 30 of the neo-Nazis that were apparently involved in the attacks
stabbings in
Sacramento are going to. Go to protect, I don't know, Trump or what they're going to go do. I hope, frankly, they're given prime time a moment to address the crowd there, and they all come out and give their salute. And maybe
they're like the shock troops or whatever.
Well, I mean, at this point, it seems like just about, I mean, it definitely feels like if there was a way to short attendance in the financial markets, there was a way to short attendance at the convention. You could make a killing, right? I mean, it just seems like
really, yeah.
And people are just like, it's going to be Ted Nugent. I mean, Ted Nugent, I have a feeling, is going to end up being, you know, like their deep bench.
Didn't they report all these sports stars, quote unquote, who were going to speak there? And then they asked a bunch of them were like, we never said. I mean, you know, what, is Mike Tyson refusing their invitation at this point?
I think he might be. I think I saw something that he said, like, I don't want
to rapist.
I don't want a part of that.
I don't want to. Like, I don't want my brand to be destroyed by Trump.
Exactly. I mean, I think Mike Ditka also had the same thing. Like, nobody ever told me about that. No thanks. I mean, I support him, but I can't make it that day because I'm going to the dentist appointment. But,
right, and they've got, you know, I mean, I thought maybe we get Bobby Knight there throwing some chairs at people, but apparently, you know, he may not be there either. I don't know. I guess he could go for, like, all of, like, the huge stars that support him, you know, Gary Busey and
right.
Scott Baio and... I mean, basically, compared to who he's talking about, somebody put this on Twitter, and I can't steal this without giving credit, to say at least somebody else came up with this. But they're going to say, you know, this team of people we're talking about here, it makes Clint Eastwood yelling at a chair seem like Shakespeare.
Right.
You know, I mean, but again, I don't know what they're going to end up doing. I know that
this year it's just going to be the chair.
They're
not even going to bring. They're not even going to bring Clint Eastwood because only the chair would show up.
None of these Senate candidates are going.
Right.
Cruz, Kasich, and Scott Walker aren't going, and Rubio has now said I think he won't go either. So you're going to have Ben Carson up on the stage, who I'm sorry, but is seems to be mentally ill. You know, you're going to have Chris Christie
could
who looks
very
like
well
he's going to be vice president.
Could very well be the vice president.
Which is hysterical. I mean, this is like the New York Knicks policy on getting basketball players. They like to get them after they've already been injured and are on the way down. this as a Knicks fan. This is what they're doing. It's like Chris Christie, he once won with 60% of the vote in New Jersey as a Republican. He now has a 28% approval rating, and most people can't stand him and want him off their lawn. But so let's pick him now. We're going to get him when he's on the way down.
Let me ask you this. There's a couple of things I want to ask you, but this occurs to me now. Like you've had a lot of experience in terms of campaigns, at least in your earlier days.
Yep.
When you have a guy who has no, and there was a story this week where the Trump campaign. Presumably accidentally. I mean, I can't imagine any other way. Emailed politicians like throughout Europe, seeking
and
Australia seeking donations to his campaign, which of course is completely illegal. You can't.
Yeah.
But the idea that you would send some Australian prime or member of parliament a solicitation is obviously a mistake. And I imagine that's indicative of just simply not having an organization or, you know, having one that has just been slapdash thrown together in the last minute, but you're trying to play catch up. But when you've got a campaign that has not created a donor list because they haven't raised any money. And so it's not just even a question of like, well, we can go round two with these people. We've tapped them out for the primary. We can go round two. There's no round two because there was no round one. A. B, you don't have a voter list. You don't have all of these things in a campaign. How much does that hurt the down ticket races? Like, how much would a guy, let's say, how much would Portman, let's say, running for a reelection in the Senate, how much was he relying on, or does he, you know, because he's an incumbent, does he already have his voter list and this and that? How much would he have been relying on updated voter lists coming from presumably a national campaign that had already run a primary in Ohio?
Well, I mean, that would be incredibly helpful. I mean, here in Ohio, a perfect example is that I don't think I would be shocking anybody when you look at some of who holds the constitutional state offices here in the legislature that during the off years, the state party was run terribly. And we've got somebody new running the party now who I think is doing a much better job. But for a decade, we had somebody who was basically a blue dog who...
On the Democratic side. Okay, yeah.
On the Democratic side. So to me, this makes the point, which is, but yet in 2008 and 2012, we had huge victories here. All up and down the ticket. Why was that? Because the fantastic operation that Barack Obama had here, turning people out, finding their voters, it led to a number of major victories that simply would not have happened without them. So it's incredibly hurtful. I mean, if they have enough money, I mean, maybe if the Koch brothers really were putting together a parallel operation, which, you know, I don't know how much of that's going on anymore. Some say they're pulling out. They're certainly not giving money to Trump. You know, or yeah, Karl Rove's group doesn't have that kind of money even to do something like that. They would just be ads. So who's going to do it? The local state party? They just generally don't have that kind of resources. You need that coming from the top of the ticket. And so it's definitely going to hurt them. I mean, especially in states that are controlled by, for example, by Democratic governors or states that in any way where they don't have an enormous infrastructure. I mean, I suppose they're lucky in that they've won a number of governor's mansions. But there's just no doubt that you want this to be a coordinated campaign working with the top of the ticket that's going to have much more in terms of voter information, resources, all the statistics and all digital that you want, you know, particularly now when so much of this has gone is digital. You know what I mean? So, yeah, he's going to put these guys at an enormous disadvantage. I mean, he's basically said he was going to outsource it to the party. Well, the party can't do all of this.
Right.
You know what I mean? They just can't. And so he's hurting them in every way possible because he's not doing his part, at least if he came with the baggage he's going to come with, which is a new stupid thing that he says or a new story about something else, something, you know, that he did that was fraudulent every day. If you had the guy who at least legitimately had lots of money, which he doesn't, was spending lots of money, which he isn't, you know, and had a turnout operation, well, at least you get the positives too.
Right.
But these guys are only getting the negatives of having Trump at the top. And I think it's going to hurt a lot of them, and that's why, I mean, someone in Portman, worst of all, you mentioned him, because he has to go to the convention. He can't make up an excuse like other people. It's in his state.
Right.
I mean,
traffic
like,
is just a
nightmare.
That must
have seemed awesome like a couple of years ago. Now it's like a nightmare.
All right, so let me ask you this, and this is a little bit off topic, and then I want to get to the Democratic platform for just a little bit. But
sure.
This abortion ruling this week, which invalidated the Texas law, but also is presumably or has created a higher standard for any state that is looking to restrict access to abortion.
That's right. The undue burden part of it.
Right.
I mean,
what's
know.
Happening in Ohio now with that? I mean, I know that you're involved in Planned Parenthood there. What is happening? What happens now on the state level on these other states that are not impacted? Do you guys start to initiate suits based upon these laws or because the state's not going to give up, right? I mean, Kasich is not going to give up.
No, I mean, and he's been a devoted anti-choicer, and our attorney general is horrific. Mike DeWine, you may remember from when he was a senator, has always been on this issue. So what I would say is I can't speak to internal conversations and stuff, as you can imagine, but
right.
Let's just say there will be a lot of things going on. There will be there should be policies pushed. My guess is you'll see some lawsuits. But yeah, because a number of the trap laws that they've put in place here in Ohio, you know, are similar to ones in Texas. And they started, you know, what they were saying, I mean, these ridiculous, let's just pick the most ridiculous one, which is the specifications of your hallway must be this wide and this, you know, I mean, it's clear that a number of things they've done are way beyond meeting that threshold and causing an undue burden. So, yes, I would expect more lawsuits to undo some of these other similar type things as to what happened in Texas, and hopefully that can lead to some of these clinics they've shut down reopening.
Okay, great. Well, all right, so let's just get up another 5 or 10 minutes here.
Yep.
One thing that Trump did this week was he went to, I think it was in Pennsylvania, he was out speaking in front of an aluminum recycling place, and really attacked NAFTA, attacked Clinton on NAFTA, attacked the TPP, attacked Clinton on the TPP, claims he's going to reopen NAFTA. I mean, putting all that aside in terms of whether or not we believe him, I don't, but it doesn't matter. How does, and I want to sort of also, you know, pivot this into this conversation about the platform, because this takes place, and I would imagine not a coincidence, during the process of the platform where it is clear the Democratic platform is not going to be explicitly be against the TPP. Reports now that Obama directly called...
not embarrassing the president.
Yeah, well, it's not just not embarrassing the president. Like, he literally, I'm trying to find specifically, but he himself personally called, where is that story? He called, who was leading the platform committee? I think it was...
oopsie, that's probably something I should know, but...
Yeah, it was. Is it Clyburn? No, not Cummings.
I know he was on
Cummings.
It.
Cummings. Cummings is the drafting committee's chairman, and according to Dave Weigel reporting, the president personally spoke to Cummings, and then basically pursued all of the other members of the committee, but for the Sanders reps, and basically said, look, we need you to support this now, or at least not have a rejection of our policy there. So now what happens between now and it goes to Orlando, there's still, and it goes to the convention, and you see Donald Trump out there hitting hard on this stuff. I mean, if there is some indication that he's getting traction with that in a place like Pennsylvania, in a place like Ohio, in a place like Michigan, I mean, what happens then?
I mean, that's a great question. You know, what do I think should happen? I guess probably people who listen to this show know what that is. I mean, I think they should have taken a much stronger stance, if not at least, I understand not wanting to sort of rebuke your own president and say we won't pass this, but certainly saying it needs to be renegotiated in ways that are more worker-friendly. And when I say that, I don't mean saying that sentence the way I just did. I mean putting specifics in there.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because anybody can say, well, we're going to make it better. You know what I mean? We've heard a lot of that kind of
rhetoric. I don't even know how they can make it better. I mean, as far as I know, it's been signed off by all the countries. So I don't know how they would reopen negotiations. Like, I don't see
maybe
how anything meaningful can change.
And maybe that means it gets scrapped. I don't know. You're right. It's a difficult situation, but I agree. Because look, I don't trust Trump. I mean, Trump is a demagogue, and he'll say anything, whether it's to do with immigration or trade, that he thinks will sell to the majority of the population. So I don't. It's not about that. But some people will believe him. And the truth is that, you know, the Democratic Party does have a problem, which is, you know, there are a lot of people who are working class voters who question whether it's on their side anymore. I mean, there's no doubt there are regions, you know, that used to be that were heavily affected by trade, that, you know, I think of Youngstown, Ohio, up in the Northeast, that's been, you know, just decimated. And these are areas that used to vote across the board Democratic, and they're going for Trump now. The bigger problem to me is you need an overall narrative, and that's something that I don't think the Democratic Party has had.
Right.
Which is, because some of this is due to trade, some of this is due to mechanization, and that's only going to continue, and technology. And so you need to be talking with people honestly and saying, you know, it's kind of like in these coal counties where Republicans are like, we're war on coal. Instead of just saying, you know, local people running for office saying, we're going to stop Obama's war on coal and repeating Republican, you know, I don't agree with my president on that. Why don't you come up with a narrative for how you're going to create, you know, clean energy jobs with a lot of the mechanization, the plants that used to create other things that have moved away. You've got this infrastructure. There's a ton of it in Ohio, for example, and that we're going to move. How are we going to move on to better paying jobs? What is the plan? You've got all this infrastructure. You've got a lot to work with. And I think, to me, that's the bigger problem here, is that it's not just about, well, you can say, okay, well, I'm against TPP. Well, then what are you for? Because that's not going to save people's jobs that are already gone.
I'll tell you what's amazing. There was a Pew Research poll that came out this week. Or maybe this was actually from March, from the end of March. Maybe it's changed since then. But this is, and I don't know, it was taken in mid-March 2016. Trump supporters on free trade, 67% say a bad thing. Okay, Cruz, 40% to 48%. So Trump is the outlier in the Republican Party. Among Democratic support, Clinton supporters, 58% say it's a good thing. Free trade, just broadly speaking. Or Sanders supporters, 55%. So in other words, what we're seeing is that this is a function of who's in office. Like there is, I mean, it's sort of shocking. And I don't know if this has changed in the past 2 months. I mean, it's possible it has. And maybe it has to be more specific. Maybe it's just sort of like a broad question. But I mean, the fascinating thing is, like, I actually think at this point that with a Republican controlled Congress, it's quite possible the Republican caucus would have to vote against the TPP. Like, it may never even get to Hillary Clinton's desk because it's just fascinating to me how this trade thing sort of bends in the wind. And you've got a Democratic platform that is to the right on this issue, then the presumptive nominee and the person who came in second to the presumptive nominee.
No, I mean, you're right. I mean, it is interesting. And I think that part of it with this is kind of the failure to put trade into a broader context, because I'm generally in favor of trade. I mean, I think it created stability after World War II. I think trading with other countries, particularly those that are sort of similar in to your own in sort of income level and with in regulations, is a good thing. I think it strengthens relationships. It can't be something, though, where you can make capital, you know, completely mobile while workers can't be. And so that's the problem here, is that they've never fitted into, you know, well, what's next? What are we moving towards? How are we replacing these jobs? Which jobs are able to be protected and kept in this country? They've just sort of...
milestones or watersheds to which to measure a trade deal other than like just some broad platitudes, it seems to me.
That's right, and that's my problem, because I want to be in favor of trade. I think it's a good thing, again. To me, it's one of many things. It's not just the economic impact. It's the foreign policy impact. War destroys wealth like nothing else, right? Mm. Destroys lives first and foremost, but destroys wealth. So, you know, not having war is a good thing. I think we'd all agree. I hope we'd all agree.
I mean, I think that's, to the extent that I have any long-term concerns about Brexit, it has more to do with sort of the long-term stability of Europe, because
my concern too. The economic thing, I don't won't be as much of a shock as people think. I worry about stability because I don't want I don't want that to lead to a movement where different countries around Europe are breaking away along ethnic groups. We've seen that not only, I'm not going all the way back to World War II, we saw that in Yugoslavia in the 90s. I don't want that. So that is why I will never refer to myself as anti-trade. I just, when you can't put together these deals that only benefit corporations and disadvantage everyone else. And certainly if you're going to pass trade, then you need to, alongside trade, there has to be what else, you know, what is the broader narrative? What are you doing here? Where's the retraining? Where's the education programs? Where are the new jobs you're putting in place? You know, this has to all be tied together as an overall economic plan. Trade in and of itself, you can't just do that, at least in my opinion. I'm not claiming to be a PhD economist, but from at least everything I see and everything I read. So that's my problem here. And I think the Democrats have left that issue out there. And because of that, because they haven't sort of stood up and had a broader narrative and said, we can pass this, but we need to do A, B, C, and D to make it worker friendly, very specifically, then it can be demagogued by people like Trump. And nobody knows what to do about it, because those people who really genuinely are concerned, well, you know, like I would think all of us, what do we do?
Yep.
You know, so I would love to see a more informed, a smarter platform around that issue as part of, what is it that we seek to do over the next, not just 5 years, but 30 years, 50 years economically? You know, where do we want to head? And I think that could hopefully be helpful very specifically. I hope I'm making any sense here, by the way.
No, totally. On that note, Cliff, I will let you go. I know I appreciate you taking the time out today, our slightly different schedule than normal. And
my pleasure.
I will hit you up this week to let you know about next week. But in the meantime, thank you so much. Folks, you should check out Cliff has got a great piece in the Daily Beast this week on this horrible gun nut who killed, it's a horrible story, killed her children and then ended up getting killed herself. But people should check that out. We'll put that up on the blog at majority.fm, Cliff. And
thanks, man.
Really just horrible situation. But
it is, and I hate to have to write about it, but you know.
Well, thanks again, Cliff. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right, folks. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to play a Jimmy Reefer Cake song, and then...
No punishment.
No.
Okay,
I got a little hot under the collar.
You
with,
were,
Jimmy
even
Reefer
for
Cake
me.
On Thursday. I just got very frustrated because I like Jimmy. He's a smart guy. He also makes great music for the show. Go check it out at allthehypocrisy.com. But I'm very frustrated at the energy and resources and what I see to be somewhat exploitive stuff that is going on in terms of this narrative about that Sanders was defrauded in some way.
He was robbed.
And that is with me acknowledging and being probably one of the first people to acknowledge, frankly, that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC was attempting, you know, was clearly trying to, starting when they announced the debate schedule a year ago, I was on TV saying, like, this is clearly, you know, this is a clear indication that the DNC is trying to help Clinton. With all that said, so, yeah, no punishment. Let's... This is Jimmy Reefer Cake's song is Strategic Voting is Not Fun. And I would say that's probably
strategic
true.
Strategic voting is not fun. That kind of math is not for everyone. Unfortunately, here in the great United States, a corporate whore and an evil jerk are the leading candidates. They say the argument for Hillary is she's at least a Democrat. Yeah, the party that rigged the election for her, yippee! How about that?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
With the FBI and election fraud controversy.
Irritation.
People are saying on all sides, hypocrisy is a disease. That's why I advise Hillary to come out strong for legal weed. If she wants to beat Donald, do it first, and it's a guarantee. So if she loses, just remember how she didn't listen to me. Yeah, if she loses, blame yourself for not supporting my man Bernie, 'cause strategic voting's not for everyone. No, 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 no. That kind of math, it's not fun. Oh, it's not fun.
Working the math in.
Yep. I do, I mean, obviously, there were some sore points in there that I, but he sent that before. But I will also say that I really do think that if you are saying, like, I am specifically not going to be strategic in the way that I vote, then you have to evaluate what you're doing. You're doing something wrong.
But even Jimmy is not saying that. Even Jimmy. And he's saying it's not fun.
He's saying not fun, but it sounded like the implication was there, like, I'm not going to do it. And, yeah. I mean, yes, it's not fun. But, you know, nobody promised you a rose garden. Nobody, we said, like, you know, when you become a citizen, fun thing to do is go and vote. No. And to vote in a way that you think is not strategic, wow, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, it's...
I always say this, but Jimmy has called in.
It's like swimming in a way that it's like I'm going to make a conscious decision to swim in a way that will keep me from keep me from being above the water in some way.
Jimmy always said, "Well, you know," but even then, actually swimming underwater can be fun. But
well, swimming underwater, over time it becomes a little bit of an issue.
But Jimmy himself always says that Paul LePage is so awful as governor of Maine. Indeed. That he kind of got the lesson from it. So I'm a little confused.
All right. Well, now, Michael, we'll throw it over to you with your interview. And folks, happy Canada Day. Happy July 4th to you Americans. I know we have a few of you who listen to this program. And after Michael's interview, we will be back on Tuesday with a new show. And we'll talk to you then.
Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Steve Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and my friend. Steve, how you doing?
Hey, what's going on, Mike?
It's always good to be speaking with you. And unfortunately, though, obviously, we're speaking really this week under some very ominous and just horrible circumstances, frankly. There was this... you know, terrorist attack at the Istanbul's airport, the Ataturk airport, on Tuesday. Over 40 people were murdered in these attacks. And look, you know, there's been a wave of attacks in Turkey, actually really over the past year. And there's a couple of prime suspects. And by explaining those prime suspects, I think you can actually help give us an idea of the present dynamics in play in Turkey right now. So who would you say the prime suspects are, and what do they represent?
Well, thanks, Michael. First of all, it is just a horrendous situation in Istanbul. And, you know, as someone who regularly travels through that airport, kind of brings home to you, you know, how dangerous the world really has become. I think there's probably 30 Turkish visas in my passport. So, right. You know, it really could have been anybody, or it could have been me, or it could have been any number of people that we both know that were caught up in that incident last night. Now, as far as suspects go, I think that there are three prime suspects. One, which your listeners, I'm sure, have heard ad infinitum, is obviously the Islamic State. And I think a lot of people are focusing in on that because that's what the Turkish government has said. The U.S. government has intimated that it seems like a Islamic State-inspired attack. And it looks like the Brussels attack, which was an Islamic State at that. But there are two other suspects. One is the Kurdistan Workers Party, known more popularly by its Turkish acronym PKK, which has been waging a war on the Turkish state since the mid-1980s. And then there's an offshoot, a breakaway of sorts from the PKK called the Kurdish Freedom Falcon. They go by the acronym TAC. People have dismissed the PKK angle. I tend to agree that PKK has really focused its attention on attacking Turkish police and military right. convoys and so on and so forth. attack has been known. Its first two, when it first, you know, appeared on the scene in 2004, actually attacked two hotels in Istanbul. And then it has conducted two other attacks in Ankara at the beginning of 2016 that killed a lot of people. So I think that, you know, it's entirely possible to keep the Kurdish Freedom Falcons within the realm of possibility of perpetrating this horrific attack at the airport.
So just to sort of further expand on that, and I want to run an analogy by you or comparison, see if it makes sense to you, to help people sort of understand this. First of all, you know, these atrocities are obviously separate from, you know, what certainly in my mind, and I know in your mind as well, are, you know, incredibly, you know, very legitimate political, cultural grievances and human rights issues involving the Kurdish people and the state of Turkey, obviously. But it seems to me that, you know, the PKK, if we were going to make a comparison, it's almost like, you know, the IRA in some respects. And the IRA committed many atrocities, including very much on their own people. But they were also, you know, they did have a bit more of an emphasis maybe on political and military targets. They were willing to negotiate and sort of do politics in a certain way. And then the breakoff, you know, the real IRA, which did not want to disarm and maybe were more, even more aggressive. So the Freedom Falcons, is that kind of the distinction? And I guess connected to that, do they have a different politics than the PKK? Or is it the same politics, just with more brutality?
I think it's a terrific analogy, and I think a lot of analogies you have to stretch here and there, but I think it fits quite well. First, let me just emphasize the fact that the Kurds do have some real grievances, political and cultural grievances, when it comes to the Turkish state, and the Kurdish and Turkish nationalism are in ways unresolvable. Yep. If only because of the policies of the Turkish state. So it exists. It's not like Al-Qaeda or ISIS that believes it's in this kind of cosmic struggle against the non-Muslim world. And as far as the analogy goes, I think that's right. I think the PKK has been willing to deal. They were negotiating with the Turkish state in 2015. These were tenuous negotiations, of course, but were willing to do a deal. TAC is much more militant on this. They don't believe in negotiation. Their politics is about Kurdish separatism, mm-hmm. and the establishment of a separate Turkish-Kurdish state in the southeastern part of Turkey. And in that way, they've sought to up the ante. They're more militant. They're not necessarily more violent, because, of course, the PKK is itself quite violent, but they have perpetrated a number of pretty horrific attacks, both this year and a number of years ago.
And didn't they say that the kind of final thing I want to touch on with them is that they've released statements sort of indicating, and this is actually the one thing, the question about who actually did this attack, because I'm with you. I think it's very stupid, certainly from, you know, maybe people in intelligence services know something different. That's another thing. But the sort of popular default response here that, oh, this is ISIS and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's actually really profoundly, you know, intellectually lazy and dangerous at this point to just sort of make that default. But the one thing that I did notice is that would maybe point towards ISIS, although it's unusual they didn't claim credit for it. But the two things, and, you know, the airport has this sort of international focus. I mean, it's a prestige target, but it's an international target. Now, the Falcons have released statements in the past essentially saying, like, look, if you come to Turkey, if you come to Istanbul from the United States, from Europe, wherever, you could get killed because we're going to do this. But you're not the target. Like, we don't have any beef with you. It's almost like we're about to have a street fight. Get out of the way. And if you're still here, you might get, you know, a bat in your face, no problem. We're not going to, you know, we're not sentimental about human life, but you're not the target here. So I guess, how do you interpret this specific attack on the airport in light of the different positions around this?
Well, look, again, ISIS is absolutely capable of attacking airports. They've done it.
Yeah, of course.
And as are the PKK and TAC. Look, in the old days in Turkey, when I traveled and lived in Turkey, they were focused single-mindedly on PKK terrorism, and at the airports, they would march you out on the tarmac, and you'd have to pick out your bag because they were worried about PKK attacks on Turkish aircraft.
Right.
So I think, like you said, I can deal with intellectual laziness. I can call people out for intellectual laziness, but I do think it's dangerous to focus almost solely on the ISIS threat. And I do think that, TAC, PKK, and ISIS all have motivation to attack the main airport in Istanbul. It's like attacking JFK Airport in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It is a kind of a symbol, the third largest airport in Europe. The Turkish Airlines is a hugely successful operation, and Turkey does have a robust tourism sector. So there's a whole host of practical, right, economic, mm-hmm, psychological, and political reasons to attack the airport. And each one of these groups that we have talked about certainly has motive to do it and the means to do it. I think it's to dismiss out of hand the PKK is not wise, although their targets have been somewhat different. But both TAC and ISIS, entirely possible in my mind.
Of course, this is coming in the context of something that you and I have discussed many times on the Majority Report, and you know, and alluded to in pieces we've written, Blogging Heads, a number of other places that we've done things together. In the sort of, you know, very erratic decision making of the present AKP government and the leadership of Erdogan, it seems, you know, interesting that even the Turkish government was sort of pushing towards an ISIS explanation, when in the past it seemed like they've almost, you know, they've been wanting to ratchet up against the Kurds and almost sort of de-emphasize the security challenge from ISIS. At the same time, and we'll get to it in a moment, we're seeing a renew of relations between Turkey and Israel and Russia, who they've had major, you know, conflicts with recently, and also, you know, there's this sort of broader NATO response and President Obama's statement of solidarity with Turkey, which I guess isn't terribly, it's not surprising at all. But in terms of how this is dealt with and the focus they're putting on this, is this a reflection of AKP government getting a little bit more in touch with reality and the hard decisions that they have to make to confront the crisis in Turkey now? Or does this sort of scattershot approach continue?
I think that President Erdogan, who really is the decision maker, is capable of making decisions at any moment and believing them in the moment, because that's, mm-hmm, that's what it is. But I do think that they have, where they started out being ambivalent about the fight against the Islamic State for fear that they would have bombs going off in the streets and in their airports, and fear that the American strategy didn't deal with the major issue for them, which is the Assad regime. They connect the Assad regime directly to the ISIS phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And because they felt that Kurdish nationalism was a greater threat, they were deeply and profoundly ambivalent about the fight. I think, though, over the course of the last 4, 5, 6 months, they have been more active in rolling up who they believe to be ISIS sympathizers, and they've paid a price as a result. There have been at least six ISIS-related attacks in Turkey over the course of the last 12 months. And so I think that this only reconfirms for them that they have this major problem right on their borders and right in their cities and right in their airports. And I think that they will they'll respond in this way. That doesn't by continuing to go after ISIS and continuing to go after the PKK and continuing to go after TAC. There's been some discussion in Turkey, can we do all of this at the same time? I think whether they actually have the capacity to do it all at the same time, the politics really, I think, dictates that they're going to have to continue the pressure on the PKK, even as they maybe turn their focus to ISIS.
Is there a possibility, though, that they could also get back to, again, another earlier feature of Erdogan's leadership, which was certainly relatively speaking to traditional Turkish, you know, sort of ultra-nationalism, there was some improvement in the Kurdish human rights situation. And it seems like that's been reversed. I mean, is there a way of sort of simultaneously dealing with the urgent security challenges, but also maybe getting back to at least some progress on those issues, or no?
One can only hope. Yeah. And that's the great tragedy of the Turkish-Kurdish conflict right now, is that the AKP government had done more than any previous Turkish government to try to resolve the overall Kurdish issue. And up until last spring, we're negotiating with, the government was negotiating with the PKK. That one can hope that they get back there. What concerns me is that the kind of Turkish, the hardcore Turkish nationalist politics that Erdogan has pursued and the party has pursued in order to secure parliamentary majority in parliamentary elections last spring and fall, is very hard for them to pull back from. But right. as you pointed out, the Turks have now pulled back from two other major issues. One, they've reconciled with Israel, and two, have issued a formal apology to the Russians for shooting down one of their planes last fall. So there is, over a period of time, evidence that the AKP and Erdogan can be pragmatic on a series of issues. So one can hope that they set aside this extraordinarily destructive conflict with the PKK and focus on what seems to be the real threat here, and that is of the Islamic State.
Absolutely. So let's touch briefly then on, and we'll get to Russia, but that seems in some ways it's a bit less complex. But the Israeli conflict goes back a long time. It goes back, in my understanding, actually back to a humanitarian vessel that was leaving Turkey to protest, the sort of blockade of supplies on Gaza. Israeli, commandos raided the ship. And to sort of summarize it, essentially, I mean, Turkish citizens ended up dead. And right. there was this, quite understandably, from a Turkish perspective, a lot of rage about this. From an Israeli perspective, I'm sure that they would argue that, Turkey was, as a national government, facilitating, a violation of their security policy. I mean, I certainly have my opinions on these things, but setting aside right. the kind of normative views aside, I think those are the sort of general outlines of both sides' positions. Do you think that for both of these players right now, though, both Turkey, which we've been touching on, just this sort of incredibly alienating, problem-creating foreign policy and domestic policy that they've been on the past couple of years. And then in Israel, this is a very, very right-wing government now that has not done itself any favors with, now I would say beyond the scope of just sort of more progressive Democrats, I think many mainstream Democrats. Is there just the need on both sides to become more normal again, or as normal as possible? And can that impulse sustain an agreement through the pushback that is inevitably going to come in Turkey? And I would imagine from, inside Israel as well.
You raise a number of important points. I think from the Turkish perspective, the motivation to finally reconcile with the Israelis comes from Turkey's relative isolation in the region and becoming wider as well. But it's no secret that Turkey's strategic position in the Middle East has collapsed since 2011. And it has become just unsustainable to maintain the current the posture that they had been pursuing, where they were isolated and targeted from a variety of different places. From the Israeli perspective, they actually feel quite normal. I was in the Middle East not long ago, and Israel was one of my stops, and talked a bit with them about the relationship with Turkey. This was, of course, before this agreement was inked. And what they said was, look, the Turks acted as if Israel could not survive in the region without the strategic relationship that they once enjoyed with Turkey. But the Israelis proved the Turks absolutely wrong. They have good relations with the Egyptians, good relations with the Emiratis, an entire set of security relations with the Saudis that nobody really knows about.
But are quite Greece powerful.
Mm-hmm. Great, Greece and Cyprus are new partners. There's tremendous amounts of Israeli gas. So the Israelis were in a position of strength, and it was a situation where the Turks needed to deal more than the Israelis did. Now, the Turkish motivation, and more specifically, was who have been leading proponents of Kurdish nationalism and Kurdish independence? They've been Israelis. And so the Turks calculated that they could head off the Israelis, and the Israelis are masters of realpolitik, by reconciling with the Israelis and hoping also perhaps the Turks would get a little bit more consideration in Washington as a result of reconciling with Israel. So it's complex. I think the Israelis were much more ambivalent at this point than were the Turks. I think it's probably good for both countries, but I think the idea that some have suggested that, this would be a new era of security cooperation, the two countries can work together. Probably not, although there have been some rumors that the Israelis had tipped the Turks off that something was coming as recent as 2 days ago, but obviously it was not, it wasn't, if it did happen, it wasn't specific enough to head off this attack.
Right. I mean, so then in that respect, maybe it's just, from an Israeli perspective, I think having another
non-Arab
country,
major country in the region have full diplomatic relations is a good thing.
Right. And then for Turkey, I think, that's actually right. They're it's a proxy for, how sort of crazy Sunni fundamentalist sympathetic we can be if we're actually cool with Israel. So then, that's a brand signifier basically. In the situation with Russia, that's essentially seems like really a Turkish climb down.
Right. That's exactly what it is. But the Russians have been beating the Turks for 800 years, and it just happened again. I think the shooting down of the Russian jet was a major miscalculation. Vladimir Putin put the screws to Erdogan, and Erdogan wasn't going to get the same kind of support that he thought he would from his NATO allies, because all of his NATO allies thought it was pretty stupid to shoot down the plane.
Right.
And so he essentially had to climb down from it. He had no place to go. No one was going to help him with the Russians, especially since the Russians have been so active and, arguably successful in getting what they want in the Middle East right now.
Right. Again, and setting the sort of normative descriptions aside, right. And in fact, being involved with, some efforts against ISIS, although, also just, frankly, shoring up an incredibly horrific and brutal regime there. But being that as it may, this is always the place that we go in these conversations before we wrap up. And I know you're about to wrap up, but it's important to at least always sort of check in on this point. No one has ever questioned that, Erdogan is nothing if not in addition, we talk a lot about how belligerent he is, how erratic, how, rage-filled, in fact. He's also an incredibly savvy, adaptive, and distinctly globally successful political figure. Are these changes...
Go ahead. No, sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's fine. I mean, my question would...
He's the best. People think that I've been very critical of the Turks and Erdogan in particular in some of the things that I've written.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of Turks misunderstand. They think that I'm in awe of his political skills. He is not only adaptable, he is charismatic in ways that, when people talk about Bill Clinton being charismatic, and this is a guy I've seen who can carry a room of non-Turkish speakers and bring them to their feet.
Yes.
So
he
has this innate, if he can do that to non-Turkish speakers, imagine how he electrifies a Turkish crowd. And I've been in those huge pro-Erdogan rallies in Turkey, and it is really, I hate to bang on the cliche, it's electric.
Well, as Steve always says to me, it's weird because he talks like Trump. But we'll be on the phone, and he goes, look, the guy's amazing. Look, it's incredible. I wrote it down. It's true. It's really true. So, no, but, being that as it may, and obviously Erdogan is the guy who runs the show, but, is this an indication at all of the fact that, does this mean that Davutoğlu, you know, has, you know, now the prime minister and a very important advisor to Erdogan? You know, does this mean that, is there anybody there that now maybe has his ear a little bit and he is just this sort of, you know, authoritarian personality, frankly, is getting checked somewhat by a party structure or advisors and encouraged to shift? Or is this just all the product of him and just another part of his personality and leadership, which is that he is, of course, actually quite savvy and canny as well?
Right. I think it's hard to know because he's been surrounded by enablers for so long. Mm-hmm. Although when he pushed Davutoğlu out in May and brought in a close advisor to him to be the new prime minister, a number of things started to change. So one can infer from that that both Erdogan and his new prime minister, Prime Minister Yildirim, had a meeting of the minds of some sort and said, none of this is working. Right. And we can make Davutoğlu the fall guy so it won't come back on us politically. And we can make some of these adjustments that will
and that would be fair, right? I mean, Davutoğlu, you know, again, not to throw him under the bus, but he was a foreign advisor. Then he's foreign minister, then prime minister until a couple of months ago. This all has happened under his guidance.
And it's true that he did resist Erdogan from time to time, but he certainly was an enabler of Erdogan's worst instincts.
Well, so basically, we have some shifts, and we can only hope for the best that it might actually have something to do with potentially renewing some type of process with the Kurds.
I think the only analytically sound thing that you can say to that is, we'll see, maybe. We'll see.
Fair enough, Steve Cook. Always such a pleasure talking with you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Michael. I'll see you soon.
Okay, bye bye. Talk to you soon.
Bye. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Shifted it.